Morning. Today's daf and ksuvos is daf mem ches. We're back at mem zayin and alpha at the two dots right in the middle of the amud. Thank the Lupin Foundation for sponsorship of the daf. Daf is learning lezeich and ishmas liba garvila bashmuel. Mem vav amud beis, where we started yesterday, really is the beginning of a new discussion in the Gemara, and that is the responsibilities that a father has to the daughter and a husband has to a wife. And the reciprocal, and the responsibilities they have in the other direction as well. And with responsibilities also comes rights and privileges, and that is what we'll be discussing today, tomorrow. We'll be discussing over the next bit, and that is what exactly are the responsibilities and the rights of a husband to a wife. The discussion started in the Mishnah from father to daughter, because the Mishnah went on to describe all the privileges that the father has in terms of the rights of his daughters. So the father can marry off his daughter, and as we've been discussing now, this is true when she's a ketana, it's also true when she's an ara as well. Nara, even though she's an independent, she has a yad, she has a hand, she can make kinyanim, she's now bas mitzvah, she's 12 years of age, but she's still under the jurisdiction of her father. And as such, the father is still entitled to many of the privileges of his daughter at that age. He can marry her off. The Mishnah says keser shtar ubia, can marry her off using any one of the three methodologies of marriage, of kinyanim, of kiddush. He gets her mitziah, he gets her findings, maisiyadeh, he gets her earnings. Hafars nedareh, the father still has the ability to annul her vows. Umekabos gitan, the father accepts the get. As Rashi pointed out back in the Mishnah, but let's reiterate because cannot overstate this. We're not talking about after she was divorced from Nisuin because, as we pointed out again and again, there are two things that remove her from the jurisdiction of her father. Number one, bagrus. When she gets to that third stage of development, when she comes a bogeris, she leaves the jurisdiction of her father. Number two, Nisuin. If she gets through the second stage of marriage with a man, so regardless of whatever age she's at, she also leaves the jurisdiction of her father. So those are the two things that remove her from the father and make her independent. So when the Mishnah says that the father accepts the get, the Mishnah has to be talking about where she only went through Erisin, she didn't go through Kiddushin, and therefore, while she's still in Erisin, so the father is the one who's still accepting the get for her. The father still is the address in terms of who's in charge. But the only thing the father does not do is the father doesn't eat peiros. What does that mean? So remember, we saw back in Rashi, Rashi said, father not eating peiros, that means that if she inherits the land outside of her father, so that land is hers. She's the title holder of that land, and not only is the land hers, but the dividends as well. The profit, the fruit that come off the land, that belongs to her. She's young, what is she going to do with all that profit and dividends? So you make a trust. You open up some sort of, well, I understand nowadays it's, you know, more modernized version of what a trust is, but I think I don't understand very well, but in other words, I basically understand. But back then, there was some form of escrow, some sort of account that was exclusive to her, and you put it in, you make a trust for her, and then when she gets older, she'll be able to use it. But in other words, the father doesn't get the peros.
The trust is set up by the father?
The father's the one responsible to set it up. The father doesn't do it, so then Basin's going to have to get involved. But in other words, right, and Basin will then have to appoint. But in other words, but it's hers. Fundamentally, the parents belong to her. And when the husband marries her, so basically all these rights that was enjoyed by the fathers are going to be enjoyed by the husband as well. Again, I'm just reviewing the Mishnah. This is just such basic information. All the benefit that we just described is also going to be enjoyed by the husband, and the husband also eats the peros. Husband gets to eat the dividends of the land, and then the Mishnah goes on to describe, and what then is the responsibility of the husband to the wife? So he has to feed her, and in the event that she's taken captive, he has to ransom her, and he has to bury her. So these are the basic responsibilities that a husband has to a wife, and these are not it, meaning there are more, which we'll talk more about later on this morning and over the course of these next couple of days of daf. But these are the basic responsibilities, and Rav Yehuda's of the opinion we saw back in the Mishnah. I'll tell you what, let's hold off Rav Yehuda. We're going to come back to Rav Yehuda later this morning in terms of the specifics of how the burial is supposed to go. But that's an outline of the Mishnah. That's what we saw yesterday, and really what we've been doing yesterday since the Mishnah, we're now in Mem Zayin Amud Aleph, is drushas and sources. And how do we know all these rights are afforded to the father or afforded to the husband when she's a ketana, when she's a nara, meaning what is the source for all this? So that's what we've been going through. We went through Two big sugyas yesterday in terms of the source. We went through the source yesterday of Kesef Kiddushin. How do we know that the father is entitled to Kesef Kiddushin? That was almost an amud of Gemara going over that source. Mitzia, what about the findings of a daughter that goes to the husband? So the Gemara yesterday pointed out that's Eva. That's a rabbinic institution. We don't have a pasuk telling us this halacha, but rather it's a rabbinic institution to create a balanced relationship between the father and the daughter. Father is going to support the daughter, and as we pointed out yesterday, by right, he doesn't have to support her in her later years. And I say that with just a tinge of sarcasm. I mean later years. I mean when she's like 8, 9, 10 years of age. He doesn't have to support her, but the expectation is that he will. He's not obligated to, but he will. But again, just to maintain a harmonious balance between the father and the daughter, so the mitzvah of the rabbis institute, the mitzvah is going to go to the father. What I just described is Rashi's presentation of the Gemara. Tosus gives a different understanding, but again, we're just reviewing. Her maisi yadeh, her earnings go to the father. So again, the Gemara quoted a pasuk. It took a little bit for the Gemara to get to its point, but the Gemara quoted a pasuk that the earnings of a daughter also go to the father as well. That brings us up to the next point, and this is where we are in the Gemara, and this is where we left off yesterday. Hafaras nedareha, talking about the father's ability to annul the vow of his daughter. So how do we know that? This is an easy one, in that the pasuk says straight out, meaning open up to the Torah, the section that deals with Hafaras Nedarim, that's Parshas Matos, and you'll see that the Torah says that when she's benu reha, she's beis aviyah, when she is in the state of Narus, she's in the house of her father. That means that the father still has the jurisdiction over her, and she makes a vow, and the father has the ability to annul the vow. Omekabels Gita, father accepts again. Again, like I said earlier this morning, like we said yesterday, this is only after Erusin. If the divorce occurs after Nisuin, so that's it. She's severed from the father. So we're talking about after Erusin, the father collects again. How do I know that? We have a Hekesh, the Gemara quotes this Hekesh a number of times, that there's a connection between exit and entrance into a marriage, and so if the father is entitled to the entrance fee, which is Kiddushin, so he's also going to be the recipient of the get as well. Okay, and the father does not eat peros while she's alive. So again, like we described earlier this morning, in the event that she inherits land, so the land is hers. Again, separate of the father, she inherits land, and the land belongs to her. The father does not eat the fruit of the land. The Gemara quotes a Braisa, and the Braisa now is going to bring down that this is subject to a machlokas. The Tanakhama, the Braisa, says that the father does not eat the peros of her land. Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, have ochel peros bechai bito. And Rabbi Yehuda disagrees. So what you have is a very basic machlokas amongst the Tanayim, whether or not the father eats the fruit. Again, the husband does eat the fruit. That was the point of the Mishnah. That was the contrast of the Mishnah between the father and the husband. A husband does enjoy the peiros of the land. The father does not, although the Braisa now brings down that this is subject to a debate. What's at the source of this debate? But my kamiflagi. So the Gemara goes on to explain. Look, by the husband, I understand, I totally get it, why the husband is going to be entitled to the fruit of her land. Because what if the husband weren't to get the fruit of her land, and then she's taken captive? So the husband's going to say, look, she was great. Right, great cook, just wonderful qualities about her, but that's a lot of money they're asking, and I'm not gonna put up that money. Meaning, and that's just, it's onerous. So the husband's not gonna ransom her. So what the Chachamim did is the Chachamim basically said to the husband as follows: look, it may never happen that she's going to be taken captive, and thank God we live in a day and age where we don't even think about it. But it may never happen that she's going to be taken captive. But look, on the other side of this equation, we're going to take her peros of her land and give it to you. And how much could that be? Say, it's a variable. You don't know. You don't know how much land it is. You don't know how much fruit it is. So in other words, we're going to give you an unending stream of revenue coming from her to you. So now, can you handle this exchange? And it's not really a question, meaning this is part of the Tanaik Suva. But can you handle this exchange? In exchange for all her peers going to you, if in the event that she's taken captive, you're going to ransom her. Okay, so the Chachamim structured the Suva to work in this way, so that it's one variable against another variable. The peers go to him, and if in the event that she's taken captive, he has to ransom her. The Gemara says, without that, the husband may balk at the idea of having to ransom her. Ela av, just give me 1 second. Let's just finish the point. Ela av ma'ika lamemar, the minim of la parik, but la vachik parik. The Gemara says, but now we're talking about the relationship of a father to a daughter. Father to a daughter. So it's a more natural relationship, and the daughter's taken captive, and the father's not going to think twice before. Well, you know, she did inherit a land, and I didn't get the peros, and you know what? The Gemara understands that there's a natural intuition on the part of the father. He's going to ransom his daughter, and he doesn't need to be incentivized for that. So, b'lav hachi parikla. That's the opinion of the Tanakhama, which, by the way, that's the halacha. Rav Yehuda savar anami memne v'la parik savar kisa nikita yilava tezo v'tifrak nafsha. And Rav Yehuda says, no, the father in this case also needs to be incentivized. Why? Because if she does get land and there's no payers going to the land, so the father may say that, you know, she had that land and she had all those dividends and she has money. Right? She needs to be ransomed. Let her ransom herself. So Rav Yehuda doesn't feel like the Tanakhama that there's this natural inclination in the father that regardless of price, I'm going to go ahead and ransom my daughter. It's my daughter. Rav Yehuda disagrees. And so therefore, in both for the husband and for the father, according to Rav Yehuda, they both need to be incentivized. Yes, honey.
What's approved on the land? Does it matter if it's Son, Barzel, or Lot?
Again, let's go over. Son Barzel land is at the beginning of a marriage. Right. Son Barzel land is basically, she says to him, look, you want the property? Meaning, she's walking in with this property. You want the property? Let's assess its value. We'll basically hand over the property to the husband, and he's now on the hook for the value of the property, the original appraised value of the property. So the property basically goes under his control. So it's not hers. We're not talking about that. We're talking about Maluk property. Maluk property where she retains the property, either because she opts at the beginning of the marriage to retain the property, or she gets the property after the marriage has begun. Either way, it's now her property, but the Chachamim give an entitlement of the dividends of that property going over to the husband. Why? So we just learned why. We're going to say it again later this morning. So that it's a quid pro quo. So that he gets the dividends, and that means now that his reciprocal for that is that in the event that she's taken captive, he has to ransom her.
Would he do the same thing if it's for Son Barzel?
Again, Son Barzel is fund. It's not hers. Son Barzel, the appraised value goes into the ksuva, so that at the termination of the marriage, he or the estate has to make good on that property, but it's his property.
So what would be the incentive for him to ransom and all that?
The incentive over here is that this is how we're structuring the deal of the marriage. In that if she has nechsim alug,
after the marriage.
Either, or she can also say before the marriage. She could decide that she does not want to put that property into the ksuva. She wants to retain that property. She wants her name to still be on that property, which is fine. But then that means then that over the course of the marriage, he'll be able to eat all the payrolls of that land. It's just a way of structuring it so that if in the event that she's taken captive, so the Chachamim say, even if, that's exactly the point, even if he didn't eat a single fruit, in other words, let's say there were no dividends, but like we said, it's a variable benefit to him in exchange for a variable benefit to her. We don't know if she's going to be taken captive. Hopefully she won't. But the idea is that we give you this and you get that in exchange. And it's a fair exchange. Again, don't ask for me for equity on this, but it's a fair exchange in that they're both unknowns. They're two unknowns.
But the exchange doesn't exist if she wants Son Barzel. She has the option of choosing Son Barzel.
So I'll tell you what. Let's come to me back later. We'll flesh it out more. But let's go on. Okay, ve'eino ochel. We did this. Sorry. Niseis yeser alav abal shu ochel v'chulei. Tan rabbanan. Kasav la peres ksus vekelim shiavo ima mi beis avia la beis baalam. Okay, let's say she writes a dowry for the husband. She writes a dowry, meaning a dowry was invested into the marriage, and fruit and clothing and dishes and whatever, an assortment of movable items that are going to be moved from the father's house over to her husband's house. Mesa lo zach habal b'dvarim halalu. Now let's say she dies. Now we're talking about the death was between Erisin and Nisuin. So in other words, she went through the first stage of marriage. She is now married, but again, only through stage one, only through Erusin she dies. So that dowry gets transferred over to the husband? No. All those possessions only enter into the marriage at only the second point of the marriage, only at Nisuin, not at Erusin. Mishum Rabbi Nasan Amru, Zachaba B'dvarim Halalu. And Rabbi Nasan says no, that already there was a financial commitment of these items, and so therefore they're going to be transferred over upon her death, even though she died between Erusin and Nisuin. What is at the source of this machlokas? Lema beplugta de Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah v'Rabbanan kemiflgi. So the Gemara now is going to try to line up a machlokas tanaim with another machlokas tanaim. And so the Gemara says, Didnan, this is a Mishnah. We will see this Mishnah in just a short couple days from now. Nisar melon is garsha, bein min Nisuin, bein min Erusin, goves hakol. If she is widowed or divorced, whether from Nisuin or from Erusin, she collects everything. Now, like we've said already a number of times, but let's say it again. Typically, generally, a ksuva is written immediately prior to the Nisuin, meaning Erusin affects the marriage. Erusin is stage one of the marriage. But the ksuva contract is, generally speaking, not written to Nisuin. Because think about it. The ksuva contract obligates the general basic obligations between husband and wife. And although they're married, they're not husband and wife living together with financial obligations towards one another until they get to the second stage of marriage. So typically, a ksuva was not written until Nisuin. Obviously, we're having a discussion right now where, for whatever reason, they wrote a ksuva earlier. And so the question is a very simple question. Even though they wrote the ksuva earlier, does that mean that everything kicks in now? Or is it written now, but only will kick in at the point of Nisuin? That's exactly the debate that we're seeing right now in this Mishnah. So again, let's restart it. Second line from the bottom. If she becomes a widow, or she gets divorced from a Nisuin or from Erusin, so Govah Zekol, she collects everything. Meaning she collects the entire ksuva. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah Omer, Bein Nisuin Goves Hakol, Min Nisuin Goves Hakol, Min Erusin Bistula Gove Masan V'Amana Mana. When it comes to having gone through the second stage of marriage Nisuin, so then yes. So then that means then that if he dies, she's going to collect everything. Meaning not only the base amount to the ksuva, but if he added anything to the ksuva as well, so that's also going to be collected by her. However, if he died from the point of Erusin, so a Basula is only going to collect 200, and an Amana is only going to collect 100. Meaning the only thing that he has resigned to have committed to her from the point of Erusin is only a base amount of the ksuva, and that's it. And only at the point of Nisuin, everything else is going to kick in. Shalom, kasavla, ela amanas lekonsa. Because even though, according to Rav Elazar ben Azariah, the ksuva was written prior to Nisuin, still, in terms of a commitment, he's not committing himself to anything written there, or I should say, most anything written in there, until the actual marriage. That's an umdana, that's a general assumption that we make. So now the Gemara is going to try to relate these two machloksim. Again, a machlokis between the Chachamim and Rav Elazar ben Azariah, and line it up together with the machlokis of the Tanakama and Rabbi Nasan. Correct. So to which the Gemara says, Laman Damar, and here the Gemara spells it out. Laman Damar lo zacha ke Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Good. And maybe now the idea that she wasn't going to be Zocha lines up with Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Again, that the commitment to the ksuva, even if pre-written, even if it predates the marriage, the commitment does not kick in until the actual Nisuin itself. And the Gemara says, and then the two opinions which also line up is that the opinion of the Chachamim are going to line up with the opinion that the commitment takes place at the time of the writing is going to fit in with the opinion of Rabbi Nasa. Okay, that's the Gemara's attempt to line it up. And the Gemara says, "Lo, the Kulei Amar k'Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah." Gemara says that everyone's in agreement with Rav Elazar ben Azariah. Why would the Gemara want to stake that claim? Rashi says the reason is because that's the halacha. The halacha falls like Rav Elazar ben Azariah, that even if the ksuva predates the nisuin, even if it was written before the nisuin, his mind is that he is not committing himself to the obligation of the ksuva until they actually get married. That's the halacha. So to which now the Gemara says, both opinions can work within Rav Elazar ben Azariah. Man damar lo zocha ka Rav Elazar ben Azariah. Now the opinion that says that she's not zocha. So that fits in wonderfully with Rav Elazar ben Azariah. Meaning, exactly. None of the commandments of the ksuv are going to kick in until the marriage. And man damar zocha, but on the side that says that she was zocha, I can look at Rav Elazar ben Azariah ella mididei lidida shelo kasav la ella amenas lekonsa. Look, this is a ksuva. It is a contractual obligation. Contractual obligation obviously involves two parties. It goes from him to her, and it goes from her to him. It's a contract. And therefore, the Gemara says we can make the following distinction. When it comes from his obligation to her, so one could say, yes, I'm writing down a dollar amount. A financial obligation from his part to her part. But the assumption is that he is not committing himself to that obligation until the point of marriage. Okay, that's going from him to her. Now, what about from her to him? I feel Rav Elazar ben Azariah did the mishum ichtunehu va'ichtenelahu. So the Gemara says, but as far as the other direction is concerned, from her back to him, so one can make the argument whatever is written is based on the fact that they are. Now married, and so maybe then she would be entitled to all the things that are written into the ksuva. So the Gemara says that may be the machlokus between the Chacham and Rabbi Nassan, but both are in agreement with Rav Elazar ben Azariah. Okay, Chai ben Zonah Satan Rabbanan. Okay, we are now on Mem Zayin Amud Beis. We're right in the middle of the Amud. And here we go. This is the basic Gemara that describes an obligation that a husband has to his wife. These are the Gemara. There are Psukim, by the way, that speak to it. The Psukim are not clear. And you'll get that sense after we get through today's daf, where we're going to see that the Gemara itself, the Braisas themselves, are not perfectly clear in terms of what exactly these obligations are. But the Gemara over here is going to speak in clarity in terms of what the obligations are. You open up a Rambam, the Rambam counts. You know, he's super organized. The Rambam says that when all said and done, there are 10 obligations that a husband has to his wife. 3 of them are min Torah, 7 of them are min Rabbanan. I didn't bring a Rambam with me, please forgive me, but you can look it up, you can count it up. The Rambam counts it as 10 altogether. So what we're going to be learning is the following, that we start with a Braisa, 10 Rabbanan. Tiknam is on a Seah Tachas Maisi Yadah. Ukvurasa Tachas Ksuvasa. Lefichach Baal Ochel Peros. So we start off with a very succinct Braisa that describes the obligation that a husband has to his wife. So, support in exchange for Maisi Adayim. Meaning that what the Bryce over here is telling us is that he has obligations to his wife, and quid pro quo, meaning that it's a reciprocal relationship where the Chachamim instituted that because he's receiving a benefit, so therefore, in reciprocation, he has an obligation. So, mizonos are in exchange for Maisi Adayim, meaning she makes money. The money goes to the husband. Her earnings go to the husband. So in exchange for that, mizonos, he provides for her he has to feed her. He has to, right, physically. He has to support her, meaning feed her. Kvurasa tachas ksuvasa. He has to bury her. He has an obligation to bury his wife, and that's in exchange for the ksuva. So in other words, that the dowry that was written into the ksuva that she brings into the marriage and written actually into the ksuva, he's going to inherit that dowry upon her demise. So in exchange for that, so he's going to bury her. And lefichach ba'al ochel peros. And then the braisa ends off very awkwardly by saying, and therefore the husband also gets to eat the fruit. That has nothing to do with the two previous points mentioned in the Braisa, and the Gemara jumps on that right away. Peres mandekar shmayu. Who is talking about Peiros? Where did that come up at the end of the Brisa? Chesur Mechzer v'Achiktani. The Gemara says, correct. We are missing a section of the Brisa, and here's what we're going to have to insert into the Brisa. Tikna Mizonos HaTach with Maisei Adah. So let's start again. Mizonos are exchanged for earnings. Okay, he feeds her, he gets her earnings. Good. That's point number one. Pirkanat Tach is Peiros. The fact that he has to ransom her. That was the missing section of the Brisa. He has to ransom her. So that if in the event that she's taken captive, so he's going to ransom her, and that's Tachas Peiros. And in exchange for that, he's going to get the dividends of her land. Ukvurasa Tachas Ksuvasa. And the Kfuras is going to be in exchange for the Ksuva. She's writing a dowry, meaning the father is inserting a dowry into the marriage that's being written into the Ksuva document. Upon her demise, he inherits all that. So in exchange for that, he has to bury her. Lefichach, just 1 second. Lefichach ba ochel peros. So, and then the bride stands off by saying, and therefore the husband eats the peros. Good. Even after giving a better clarification of the Brisa, that last phrase of the Brisa still sticks out like a sore thumb. What my lefichach? What does that mean? So ma'u detema mechalo nechlinu anuchi nanchinu. So the Gemara says, well, maybe as follows. Maybe he could suggest the following. I'm not going to eat the fruit, meaning I'm not going to help myself to the peiros of her land. And let's leave them aside. Let's take all those dividends and put them roll them over into some sort of trust. And let's do that. To which that's what the Bryce is addressing. No, you can't do that. Because what's going to then end up happening is, let's say she's taken captive. Let's say her trust is just not going to be enough money in order to ransom her. We turn to the husband, we say, interested in ransoming your wife? And he says, no, I didn't take the fruit. I didn't take the dividends. I left that for her. If there's enough there, great. And if there's not, so no. So kamash malan da adifa zimnan delamalu uparik le midide. So the Gemara says this is a better situation for her, meaning that it's true that she's going to be giving up the dividends. And again, like I explained earlier this morning, that we don't know what the number is. Meaning these are two unknown entities. We don't know how much her dividends are. We don't know how much the ransom is going to be. That's exactly the point, right? Nichale. Let me read that again. Da difa zimnan delamalu parik le midide. We don't know what it is. Her trust may not be enough. By him enjoying the peiros, he's going to dip into his pocket, even if it means that he's going to be paying more than what the dividends were. Doesn't matter. That's what's going to be. Okay. Yes.
No. When you said about the ketubah, does she use also the 100
zuz
or the 200?
100 zuz, 200 zuz is a settlement payment that she gets at the end of marriage. And as the Gemara said earlier, that's just a way for him to force himself to think and rethink before ending the marriage.
Yeah, but if the marriage is ended, when she dies, the marriage is ending.
Right.
So shouldn't she use that money for her burial?
She only collects if he predeceases her.
I see. And if she dies,
he's not
obligated for the money.
No. That's correct. Okay. The Ebuchana, back to the Gemara. Gemara now wonders, wait a second. Maybe things could be switched around a little bit. Meaning, in the Brisa, as explained by the Gemara, we now have basically three reciprocal relationships that exist, financial relationships that exist between a husband and wife. He feeds her, earnings go to him. He buries her, the dowry ksuva goes to him. He enjoys the peiros in the ransom. If necessary, he ransoms his wife. The Gemara says, Epochana, why not basically, let's play a little bit of a shell game. Why don't we mix and match some of these responsibilities/benefits? And as Rashi points out, what's essentially the Gemara asking over here, the last Rashi on the Amud, is that if we're going to play a bit of a shell game where we're going to switch around the responsibility benefits of any of these three, so that means then that, and we're going to see more of this later in the Gemara, is that maybe she could waive a benefit, and in the exchange he could waive that particular responsibility. Meaning once we know how to line up the benefit responsibility diagram over here, so then we know if one gets waived, what goes with it. And so what the Gemara wonders now is it specifically these benefits go to these responsibilities? And the Gemara says, yes. Amar Abaye, Tiknu Matzu L'Matzu V'Shena Matzu L'Shena Matzu. So Abaye says yes. And the Chachamim were very specific about why. Because we're going to go from common to common and uncommon to uncommon. Meaning, earnings and eating. Okay? She needs to eat every single day. Okay? Fine. So in other words, that's matzui. She works. She earns. So that's also common. That's also daily. So in other words, the Chachamim...
Huh? So he has to feed her even if she does bring income. So what... I don't understand.
No, but... That part's understood. But the reciprocal relationship where she now is going to have an earning and that earning is going to go to her husband and that's done for her feeding. We'll see later on, she could say to the husband, look, I'm making a killing over here. I'll tell you what. You keep your food. You keep your food and I'll keep my earnings. Okay? And as we'll learn later on, she has the right to do that. So now that we know how they match up, so now we know if she declines food, what does she get to keep? And it can't be that she gets to choose another option. Meaning the menu is very specific in terms of what benefit is going to what to what responsibility.
If she doesn't have any earnings, the husband still has to put
Correct, correct. But in other words, an exchange... Correct, but an exchange...
In exchange for what? No earnings.
Right.
No earnings. Why would you...
Understood, but that responsibility is matching with her... that responsibility of the husband is going to be matched with her earnings.
But there's no earnings. She's not going to have it.
So fine. So if there's no earnings, so then he still has the responsibility to feed her, as we'll talk about in just a moment. But she can say, I'll take a pass on that, and she gets to keep her earnings, meaning that's part of the understanding of why we match them up.
Default is not earning.
Correct. So, and the uncommon things are going to get matched together, meaning death is going to occur, if I'm not mistaken, once. So, right, I'm pretty comfortable with that number. So that means, obviously, that's something which is eno matsui. So for that, how many times is he going to inherit her dowry? So once again, that's going to be a one-time event. So that's why they match up very well. And the dividends and the ransom, so I know it's a bit of a strange shidduch, the dividends of her property and the ransom, but the point is, I know I've said this earlier this morning, but the point is that they're both variables. You don't know what her dividends of the property are going to be, right? I understand, you know, when you buy stock, you pretty much know. But we're talking literally over here, the fruit of her field. So she may not have land to begin with. Even if she does, you don't know what it's going to yield. So that's a variable. The idea that she's going to be taken captive, we don't know. In other words, that's, again, it's an unknown. So that's why they match up. Okay. Amar Rava, Itana Savra Mizonos Medar Raisa Detanya. Rava says, let me introduce you to a Braisa. Meaning the way we're presenting Mizonos right now is that Mizonos is not a Torah obligation. Meaning it's the rabbinic obligation that the husband has to a wife. In exchange for that, he gets earnings. But the Gemara now says, I'm going to show you a Tana who is of the opinion that Mizonos is Daraisa Detanya. Gemara says, we learned in the following Braisa. She'ira. The Gemara is quoting for the Pasuk from Parshas Mishpatim, Shmos Chaf Aleph. It is the very short list of obligations that the Torah says that a husband has to his wife. Sheirak Susa Ve'ona. Okay, what do those terms mean? As we'll see in just a moment, we're not perfectly clear what they mean. They're various opinions. So here the Gemara quotes the Braisa. In the Braisa, we're going to see three opinions. Number one, Sheira Elu Mizonos. So according to the Tanakhama of this Braisa, Sheira is a reference to food. Okay. So the quoting a pasuk from Navi, again, the pasuk in Navi is a Gilui. In other words, it's just, we can't learn halacha from Navi, but it can help us define what terms are in the Chumash. So here's a perfect example, where the word she'er used in the pasuk, not perfectly clear what it means. We have a pasuk in Navi, it's a reference to food, husband is obligated to feed his wife. But again, that's now in the Torah. Ksusa kemashmao, ksus. So the Gemara says that's simple, that means clothing. And onasa zu ona ha'amura b'Torah. And ona is reference to relations, the intimacy between husband and wife. It's an obligation the husband has to his wife. And again, there we have a pasuk in Chumash that speaks to this idea. Remember when Yaakov leaves Lavan, somewhat in an awkward fashion, they end up meeting up with one another, and they finally make some sort of peace with one another, right, by the rock called Galeed. Yegarsa Dusa. So anyway, over there, so there was a a meeting of the minds between Yaakov and Lavan, and one of them was, you cannot take another wife in addition to my daughter. That's what Lavan demanded from Yaakov. Im ta'aneh es benosai. So, and also, the pasuk over here has been quoted, says that also you have the responsibility of Ona with my daughters, Lavan says to Yaakov. Anyway, but the point is that, according to the Tanakam of this Brisa, she'er is food, ksus is clothing, Ona is intimacy. Those are the three biblical obligations that a husband has to a wife. And it sounds like the way the Gemara is presenting it, according to Rava, it's not quid pro quo, meaning it's not an exchange, it's just simply, that's the starting point of the obligation. Rav Elazar Omer, She'er Zu Ona. Rav Elazar has a different interpretation. She'er is a reference to Ona. V'chein Omer Ish Isha Kol She'er Bisara Lo Sakrivu Legalos Erva. The word She'er in the Torah often is used in the context of relations. So the word She'era is a reference to relations. Okay, so according to Rav Elazar, now we have... It's the same obligation, but derived from the first word in the pasuk. Ksusa kamashmo. Ksusa again is very simple. That's reference to clothing. That's the easy one. Onasa elam azonos. And ona is a reference to food. V'cheinu omer v'ya'ancha v'yarivecha. Now, what happened over here between the Tanakam and Rav Elazar? The conclusion is the same conclusion. It's just a question of what pasuk means what. Is there a practical difference between the opinion of Tanakam and Rav Elazar? Ostensibly, the answer is no, but okay, they're just arguing over what the parish is. We're now on the top of Mem Chesam and Aleph, today's daf, and this is the third opinion in the Braisa. Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov Omer, Sheirak Susa. Meaning, well, here's what he's going to do. He's going to understand the pasuk to mean that the Torah obligation of a husband to wife is clothing. Now, I know there are three terms over here, but the three terms used in Chumash all revolve around clothing. And it goes like this: She'ira ksusa, lefum she'ira, tein ksusa. Based on her body, that's the kind of clothing you need to give her. She'lo yitein la lo she'yalada lezekena v'lo she'zekena le'yalada. Meaning, if she's young, give her the clothing of a young woman. If she's older, give her clothing of an older woman. Old woman's clothing, young woman's clothing. What are we talking about? Take a look at Rashi. Rashi explains lefum she'ira. Second Rashi on the Amud zekena kashala masui ve'ena yechol alizbo begadim rechavim v'yaldat zricha begadim rechavim li'itnaud behem. So the older woman, for her, heavy clothing is a burden. In other words, she would like a lighter clothing. In other words, for her, comfort is more important than the way she looks. For a younger woman, so the way she looks is more important than comfort. So in other words, you have to clothe your wife appropriately in terms of her age. Ksusa v'onasa. And once again, now according to Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov, the word ksusa is being modified by the word onasa. Meaning, I hope I'm explaining this well. According to Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, that center word ksusa is the obligation that a husband has to his wife. And the she'ira and the onasa on both ends are modifying the ksusa. So now, the onasa is modifying the ksusa. So lefum onasa tein ksusa. Based on the season, that's how you're supposed to clothe your wife. In the winter months, heavier clothing. In the summer months, lighter clothing. So in other words, the clothing not only has to conform to her age, but also has to conform to the season as well. Comes out that according to Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, min haTorah, there's only one obligation that a husband has to his wife, and that's giving her clothing. I realize it's a little bit strange. Meaning, of all the necessary things that a wife needs, the Torah only demands clothing and nothing else. Okay, and then it was the Chachamim who came in and gave her all the gave him all the other responsibilities / obligations. I guess that's the conclusion. But all right, just Tani Rav Yosef. The Gemara quotes a brisa of Rav Yosef. Sheirazu kirev basar. So again, so Rav Yosef quoting a brisa similar to the second opinion that we saw in the previous brisa, that she'ira is a reference to the intimacy between a husband and wife. Shelo yinag ba minag parsiim shemesham shemitosem balavusheim. And the Gemara says is that the Jewish marriage cannot behave like the Persians. Persians had relations with their clothing on. Gemara says that's not how the Jewish husband and wife should be. They should be with the clothing off. Gemara says that is part of the responsibility of and learned out from She'era. The Gemara says this is such a important aspect of the relationship, it is grounds for divorce. In fact, if he's bent on the idea that they're going to be extra modest and they're going to have clothing, so he says that it's grounds for divorce. She can demand a divorce and she'll be entitled to her ksuva, meaning that it's simply unacceptable. Rabbi Yehuda Amar Afilo Anisha B'Yisrael. Okay, and now we go back to our Mishnah. The Mishnah taught us that that he has to bury her, and his responsibility of burying her means that he has got to give her a proper burial. What does that mean? So Rabbi Yehuda in the Mishnah said, I'll tell you what a proper burial is: two flutes and one woman wailing. They hired back then. Things haven't changed much over the course of history. Meaning, you know, if you're a member of a community and you have a rav, so then you know the rav will take care of it. But in other words, it's a terrible expression, but rent a rabbi. You know, you need a eulogy, so you hire somebody to eulogize. Back then, that was much more the accepted practice. Well, you hired a professional eulogizer, and you also there was music accompanying the funeral. Obviously, I imagine the music would be appropriate for the funeral, and also a woman wailing. Okay, that part I've never seen it. It's hard to imagine, but anyway, okay. Back then, that was the minhag. The minhag was to hire people playing new instruments and women wailing. And Rav Yehuda is very specific in the Mishnah. You know, when he buries his wife, it's got to be two flutes and one woman wailing. And even yesterday, when we saw the Mishnah, like you know, we all smiled at the idea of Rav Yehuda being very specific in terms of what his responsibility is burying her. And obviously, Rav Yehuda is driving at a point, and now the Gemara is going to spell out what exactly is Rav Yehuda's point. And here it gets interesting, because what the Gemara assumes now is that the Chachamim disagree with Rav Yehuda, meaning Rav Yehuda is not just stating an opinion, he's stating a different opinion, meaning inherent in the opinion of the Tanakhama is no, it's not necessary. And Rav Yehuda is countering that unstated opinion, and Rav Yehuda says no, it is necessary. And now the Gemara is wondering out loud, what's that issue over here? Heichidami. Ida orcha, my time into Tanakama. Now, anytime you have a marriage, so you have two different families at two socioeconomic levels getting together. Now, typically what I end up finding is that matzah minas mino, people end up marrying their like, right? The wealthy marry wealthy, and the non-wealthy marry non-wealthy. That's generally speaking how it works. But even when all said and done, obviously it's never a perfect match, and everyone's coming from different socioeconomic, and it you know sometimes takes a while for the husband and wife to get used to what the other one was used to in life. In other words, she was at a certain class and he was at a certain class, and and it's a halachic issue. In other words, I understand it's a you know let's get a long issue. It's a marriage issue, but it's also a halachic issue. Is he by halacha required to move up to her class? Or is she required to come down to his class? That's a halachic discussion. To which the Gemara says as follows. Look, she died. He's burying her. And so now she comes from a particular family. So now, e de orcha maitama de tanakama, de amar lo. If this is what, in her family, things are the way it's used to, where two flute players and one woman wailing. So if that's what she's used to, so then what's the issue? How can the Tanakhama argue? The idolavorcha maitamad Rav Yehuda. And if this in her family is not what's quote unquote normal, so then what is the what's Rav Yehuda's position? Lo tzricha kagon de orchei di day v'lavorcha di da. Okay, Gemara says like this. The two people got married. He comes from wealth and she comes from less than wealth. And what happens is that she died. And now he's burying her. So under whose standards is she going to be buried? Tanakama Sava Kiyaminanola Imo Ve'eno Yoredis Imo Hani Milamechayim. So according to the Tanakama, yes, it's true. She gets upgraded to his standard of living. Meaning he can't say to his wife, look, I know I have a certain standard of living, but you don't come for money. So you know what? I enjoy my standard of living, but you don't necessarily have to come on board with me. He does not have the right to say that. Meaning he marries her, she comes on to his standard of living if it's a presumed higher standard of living. Fine. But the Tanakhama says that's while she's alive. But after she's dead, so now There can't be a demand by, I understand she's dead, so it's not by her. But the contractual obligation of the ksuba is not demanding of him that he has to keep that kind of standard for her. So therefore the Tanakhama says, it's a simpler funeral, something that was befitting for her family before the marriage, fine. That's the Tanakhama's position. And Rav Yehuda Savra, and Rav Yehuda says no. Even at this point in time, her standard still has to... Sorry, let me start that again. He has to keep his standard with his wife, even in this last rite of burial. That's at the key of the machlokas between the Tanakhama and Rav Yehuda. While they're alive, no disagreement. He has a higher standard of living. She comes on board. She enjoys that higher standard of living. And the only issue over here is post-mortem for the funeral. Amar Chisda, Amar Maruk, V'alacha K'Rav Yehuda. The Gemara says that the halacha follows like Rav Yehuda. Interesting position. It's the Chachamim arguing with Rav Yehuda, but the Gemara says the halacha follows like Rav Yehuda. So that means that she enjoys the standard of his socioeconomic level, even in her funeral. And then the Gemara, and we finish up today with a couple of basic halachas regarding the caretaking of a wife. And let's say a man goes crazy. Right? Husband literally goes out of his mind, he goes crazy, and right, we're talking clinically, he's insane. And so he can't function anymore. So Beis Din now at this point in time comes in, appoints a custodian, or now, as I learned better over the weekend, a trustee. Either way, basically the trustee now is going to use whatever's left of the estate to take care of the wife and the kids. And Davar Acher, right now the Gemara is being a little cryptic. We're going to explain what that means in just a moment. Amale Ravina Ravashi Maishna Mehadetanya. The Gemara says, interesting, because let's compare this to a brisa that we're going to see later on the Masechta, much later on. Mishalach Lemedina Seyam, let's say the husband goes on a long trip. Vishto Tavaz Mezonos. And the husband gave no instruction in terms of how the wife is supposed to be taken care of, and he's gone, and he's gone for a long time. And later on we'll talk more in detail about how long we're talking about. But anyway, but the wife goes to Beis Din and says, look, my husband has an obligation to take care of me, to feed me. He's gone. Help. So Beis Din Yardin L'Chasav is out of Mepharnes in Ishto. So Beis Din says, you're right. Beis Din will go into his estate and Beis Din will take asset from his estate in order to feed her. He is responsible to do so. So Beis Din will take care of her based on his estate. But fine, which right now poses no problem to what we saw earlier, but here becomes a problem. But the children are not going to get supported by the estate. Only the wife is. So, a very simple problem. When he went crazy, so Beis Din will assume responsibility of his estate and feed the wife and the children. When he goes off on a long business trip, Beis Din will come, seize control of the estate, but only to feed her, not the children.
Are we assuming that Jonas is above a certain age here?
Yeah. That's going to be exactly the point. So the Gemara says, obviously you're comparing apples and oranges. There are two trips that are being described over here. Number one is trip away from sanity. So the Gemara says that trip is shalomidas, meaning obviously he didn't ask for it. For whatever reason, Kadosh Baruch Hu in his infinite wisdom decided that he needs to exit his sanity. So there, obviously that was totally unexpected. Beis Din will come in and assume that not only did he want to feed his wife, but he wanted to feed his children as well. Okay. However, he goes on a business trip. Okay. And now I guess you can call him insane for leaving his wife and his children unaccounted for and not taking care of them. But be that as it may. Okay. In other words, right now he's of sound mind and body. And he goes away. So his wife is going to get fed by the estate, right? She goes to Beis Din, and the moment she says to Beis Din, my husband's not feeding me, Beis Din's going to assume control of the estate and feed him. And the Gemara explains, but there, he's obligated, meaning that's part of the ksuva obligation of the husband to feed his wife. She has a legitimate taina, and therefore she's going to be fed by the estate. But, and I know this is odd, but the children, as long as they reach a certain age, are not obligated to be fed by the father. And so therefore, the father left, It wasn't insanity. So in other words, it wasn't unexpected. He left on a business trip. He knew what he was doing. Again, I'm not describing this as in terms of ethics and morals. We're discussing right now his financial responsibility. He is not financially bound to feed his children. So therefore, Beis Din does not have the right to take from his estate in order to feed his children. That's the difference between the two cases. Fine. My dava acher. Let's finish up. The one of the things we just mentioned over here is that the husband does not when Beis Din comes and assumes the estate and takes from the estate. So if he went insane, so feed the wife, the children, and also will take from the estate for dava acher. What does that mean? Rav Chista Amar Zeh Tachshit. Okay, not just food for her, but also. Her hair, her nails, or you know, her cosmetics. Meaning, she gets to still take money in order to make herself look good. Rav Yosef Amar Tzedakah. Rav Yosef, what an interesting opinion. And they're both interesting opinions. But Rav Yosef says you take from the estate so that they can give tzedakah. Meaning, not only is there a lien on his estate to take care of his wife. That's a contractual obligation. There's also a lien on a person's estate for tzedakah as well. Now, if you're taking for a tachshit, you for sure are taking for tzedakah because, again, tzedakah is a responsibility. But if you hold that it's tzedakah, so the Gemara says, look, tzedakah, maybe that's something that you don't take from the estate. But tachshit, that you do take from the estate because you don't want her to become unkept. Let's just finish up. A person's goes overseas and she dies, so Beis Din goes into his estate and buries her based on his kavod. Lefi kvodo v'lo kfi kvodo, ema af lefi kvodo. V'kamash v'lan, o le'imo v'eino yoris imo v'afi la'achamisa. Like we concluded just a couple minutes earlier, meaning that she's going to get buried, even if the husband's not there, it's part of the contractual obligation, the ksuva, Beis Din will come, take money out of his estate in order to pay for the burial, and even if it means that she's getting a class of burial that befits him, like Rav Yehuda says, that's what we do. Am Rav Masna Omer Emesa Lo Tikbaru Am Nechasav Shemam Lo. If she dies, don't bury from the Nechasim. So we listen to Maishna Ki Amar. The Gemara says, what are you talking about? So Dinafli Nachse Kami Yasme. So the Gemara says, look, when he dies, the estate goes over to the children. Kilo Amar Nami, even if he doesn't say anything. Nechse Kami Yasme Ramum. The Gemara says, no. What we mean is as follows. If let's say a person says, look, when I die, here's my last wishes. Don't bury me based on my using my money. Meaning, use somebody else's money to bury me. The Gemara says to that, Ein shomem lo. Lav kol yemen shiashirs banav v'yapil asmal al tzibor. A person cannot do that. A person cannot empower, enrich his children at the expense of the community. Meaning that it's a responsibility for a person to bury himself. It is a responsibility on the children to bury the parent. And what a person cannot do is say, look, let's save on that. The community will bury me. My children get to keep the money. A person does not have that kind of right and ability. That's what was meant by Rav Huna, having nothing to do with a husband's responsibility to bury his wife. It was a separate point altogether. Okay, we'll stop over here. Tomorrow we pick it up on the Mishnah on the bottom of the Amud.